Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Please be advised that an investment committee meeting of the Annuity and Pension Board has been scheduled for Thursday, September 2nd, 2021 at 9 a.m. This meeting will be conducted via teleconference. Good morning, everyone. Can we start with a roll call?
Mr. Campbell?
Here.
Ms. Ford?
Here.
Ms. King?
Here.
Mr. Klusman?
Here.
Mr. Conrad is excused. Mr. Kovac?
Here.
Ms. Sawa?
Here.
And Mr. Bell?
Here.
Quorum.
Do you want me to read off everybody else's presence?
That'd be great. Thanks, Terry.
Mr. Bell, Ms. Sala, Ms. Ford, Mr. Gopalan, Mr. Silva, Mr. Sala, Mr. Robertson, Mr. Campbell, Mr. McGlynn, Mr. Bell, Mr. Jakin, Ms. King, Mr. Kovac, Ms. Erdewine, Mr. Cortright, Mr. Klusman, and Mr. Lubarski, Mr. Allen, Ms. Wells, and Terry Skeeky.
Thank you. Terry, we'll get started with the first item on the agenda, the approval of hedge fund of funds manager search and candidate profile. And it's going to be handled by individuals from Callan. Is it Pete or Mike?
Good morning. This is Mike Jakin from Callan.
Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having us this morning. So as you all remember, following our absolute return structure study at the end of July, one of the outcomes was we decided to hire an additional hedge fund of fund manager to diversify the UBS exposure within the portfolio. And so I'll walk you through just sort of the process as we go from here. Today we're going to talk about the candidate profile. And the process as we go is, you know, we'll look to our database for our hedge fund of fund manager database to identify appropriate candidates. And we'll, you know, identify a broad set. As we go along, we'll work with staff to continue to whittle that list down. And ultimately, we'll take a list of probably around a half a dozen to our alternatives review committee, which will review the candidates. And that committee is made up of about a dozen senior consultants at Callan that work with clients and have some area of expertise and experience with clients investing in alternatives. And so what we're going to come out of that committee with is a list of finalists for you to consider, and that should come near the end of the year. But the first step is what we're talking about today, and that's the candidate profile. So we want to all be on the same page in identifying what qualities and characteristics we're looking for in a new hedge fund to fund manager. And so this morning we have Joe McGuane here. He is our head, the head of our hedge fund to fund research group. You all know Jim McKee. I believe Jim retired just 2 days ago. So his last day at Callan was August 31st. And so Joe's been on board with us for a couple of months, and he'll give you some background on his past and experience, and then he's going to walk you through the candidate profile as we go forward. Any questions?
Great.
Joe, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Mike. Well, it's great meeting you all this morning. As Mike mentioned, my name is Joe McGuane. I recently joined Callan, the head of hedge fund research with the retirement of Jim. Previously, I was at Marquette Associates, an institutional investment consultant based in Chicago. So I remain in Callan's Chicago office. Look forward to meeting you all in person at a later date, but it's great joining you today. So yeah, as Mike mentioned, I just want to kind of go over this candidate profile from a high level. The focus of the search is going to be similar to the 2014 search. We're going to be looking for an absolute return manager with limited directional exposure. The target return that we're looking for, again, is going to be similar to what we have currently. It's a T-bills plus 4% for the return expectations for fund-to-fund managers to be considered. We want this to be similar to a fixed income-like return. So when we're looking at risk measures for managers to be considered, they want to have similar risk, which we look at by standard deviation, similar to fixed income. One note to change, we'll be looking for managers that have at least $5 billion in assets under management. However, on a select basis, we will consider managers with less than that, but we think given the size of this allocation, managers with $5 billion up are probably more qualified to be involved with the search than those below $5 billion. Teams that we're looking for some of these managers that we'll be going through the process with. We're looking for senior leadership that's been working together for 5 years. We want to see teams that have been, you know, working over multiple market cycles. That's always a positive for us when going through that research. And one thing to note when we're looking for, so we're going to be focused on a fund of one or commingled vehicles. Both options do not create or place more burden on staff. The burden will be placed on the hedge fund to fund managers, not on staff. That's one key thing I want to note, similar to our current exposure right now with UBS. And that's what we'll be looking for moving forward, where the fund to fund manager is involved with the whole process of sourcing, capital flows, due diligence, you name it. It's on them, not staff. So that's one thing. And obviously through our research process, internal research process with committee and staff, we'll be kind of reviewing historical performance, rolling period returns, their Sharpe ratios over time, and performance to relative to hedge fund benchmarks. So, you know, and a couple other things too we'd like to see from some of these candidates that we'll bring to you. We want them to have experience with public clients. That's always key. Good client servicing too. We need investor relations professionals that can articulate what's going on to us and staff. That's always a positive. And we're also looking for funds that provide diversification to the current manager lineup you have right now. And again, key, as I mentioned, I'm repeating myself, but we need strong transparency from a manager that we hire. We need to know what's going on in the portfolio. We need to know what's in there. And I think that's one of the main takeaways as well, too. You know, things that we're staying away from, too, we want to avoid, you know, managers that have extreme manager concentration. Or a strategy concentration as well, too, where they're focused in or they have a large allocation to one particular strategy because they think the market is really good for that. We want to stay away from that. We're looking for managers that are more diversified in nature. And we're also looking for, we're looking to avoid any fund level leverage that will be put on the fund. Underlying managers may have some leverage under there, but we do not want the fund-to-fund manager putting added leverage on top of that. That's not something we want or be looking for moving forward. So I'm going to pause there. That's kind of a general overview of what we put together here. I'd like to open it up to questions from staff and the board, and we can go from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that. Any questions yet from board members or staff? Not hearing any. I just have one but quick question. Joe, or Mike, it would be my understanding that this list that you're pulling the potential candidates from is an in-house list. How often is that updated, or is that something that gets adjusted from time to time to include new options or get rid of old ones that are underperforming?
Yeah, so I can jump in, and Mike can follow up. But yeah, so this is a list on a quarterly basis we're reviewing. And so, yes, we are looking at it on a quarterly basis. We have a really good sense of who's in the space right now. If anything, the fund-to-fund space is contracting, not expanding. So when we would kick out some managers or adjust the list is more for performance-related issues or them going away. So, yes, to answer your question, on a quarterly basis, we are reevaluating the list internally and making adjustments where we see fit.
Yeah. Matt, this is Jerry Allen. I have a question that hopefully will be useful for all the trustees. You mentioned that the portfolio characteristics that are desired would be fixed income-like. And so could you give the trustees some indication? I realize it's fund-to-funds with multiple strategies, dozens probably. What sort of instruments do you think would be in the portfolio that would have fixed income-like characteristics, but still be likely to be found in a hedge fund?
Yeah, so the shorter answer is that a lot of these managers can use a lot of different instruments, so they will be in fixed income. They'll be investing across investment grade, high yield, distressed, stressed. We'll be investing across equities, you know, growth equities, value equities, going long and short. They will be some use of derivatives too, depending on the strategies that are involved. And you know, some of the equity strategies well too, they'll be market neutral, meaning they'll be long and short, trying to hedge out some of that risk, and same with fixed income as well too.
Right.
So when you add that all up to a diversified portfolio, it does get you that fixed income like returns. So there may be anywhere from 20 to 30 managers underlying the fund to fund managers. So that's how we get more of those fixed income like returns, because we're being much more diversified in nature, with some managers taking more risk than others, and other managers taking less risk. So to answer your question, it will be all different types of instruments that we all are familiar with and that we track on a regular basis, but it's been a more diversified manner, which gets us to that T-bills plus 4% at fixed income like return that we're shooting for this search.
And again, I realize this is a fund of funds that has multiple managers, but can you give the trustees some sort of an idea of the likely range of leverage that's going to be involved with these funds, the underlying funds?
So typically, we'll have transparency into that when we're doing our research in managers. But from our past research, you will have folks that maybe have one turn of leverage. You know, they might have 1x leverage to 3x leverage. Going out more than 3x leverage is not something most fund-to-fund managers or ourselves are comfortable with. So we do not expect to see folks with much more leverage than that in the underlying portfolio. If there is someone with a, you know, like 3x levered up position, you'll see other managers in the portfolio that have even less leverage, maybe one times leverage. So they'll make sure that if someone is highly levered, like 3%, 3x levered, there'll be others in the portfolio that are very less leveraged. So that'll be one of the things we'll be focusing on too when we're calling the list down to 6. We'll be drilling down in the manager level data to see who may have added leverage. And if they do, which is fine, we want to make sure we understand what the other 29 managers have. What does their leverage look like? So someone of the 30 may have a little bit elevated leverage, but we want to be comfortable not only with their leverage, but everyone else's leverage to make us more comfortable to go into a manager like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Any other questions or comments? All right, not hearing any. I thank Mike and Joe for joining us this morning. Any final thoughts? If not, we will move on to item number 2, the PA Capital due diligence report. Is that going to be Tony?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, we do need a approval motion for this to move forward with the search.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Have a motion for the approval of hedge fund of funds manager search and candidate profile.
This is Ms. King, I'll second.
A second. Thanks, Ms. King. Now, moving on to item number 2, the PA Capital due diligence report. I believe it's going to be handled by Tony.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Bell. Good morning, everyone. I hope you all had an opportunity to review the memo included in the package materials. Mr. Silver and I completed our virtual due diligence with PA Capital, formerly known as Private Advisors, in May of 2021. We wanted to highlight a handful of notable updates since staff's prior visit in 2019. First, just a quick refresher on PA Capital. PA Capital was hired in 2014 as part of the search for a small buyout private equity fund to funds manager. The pursuit of the small buyout strategy was driven by an initiative to enhance areas where the core private equity portfolio had relatively light exposure. PA's focus of their strategy is in the lower mid-market, with the primary focus on buyout managers. As of December 31st, 2020, ERS has committed a cumulative $95 million across funds 6, 7, 8, and 9. With an additional $15 million approved for Fund 10, which is expected to launch early next year. The notable items worth mentioning, PA Capital not only announced a strategic partnership under the New York Life Alternatives umbrella in the recent past, but we also observed a few shifts in their team structure, their product offerings, and their personnel responsibilities. So as mentioned, PA Capital, they shifted their investment team structure from separate distinct groups into more of an integrated structure, as they call it, with all investment professionals contributing across all areas. So staff, we inquired as to the reason why for the shift, and it was noted to us that there was a drive for increased information sharing among investment team members, but those investment team members are still able to focus on their specializations within the private equity program. PA Capital also recently launched a GP Stakes product offering, which is part of their private equity program. The GP Stakes is being led by Todd Milligan, who formerly was the lead on the multi-manager, or what was known as the primaries team, where ERS is invested. Staff was informed that Mr. Milligan is still involved in the multi-manager product, and we were pleased to hear that Mr. Milligan still serves on the investment committee and is still involved in sourcing multi-manager deals. It was also noted to staff that PA Capital would not be filling Mr. Milligan's position, but rather promoting from within. We learned that Key Rab and Louise Wolf-Smith would take on the multi-manager leads. Both Ms. Rab and Ms. Wolf-Smith have combined 32 years of experience at PA Capital. And then one final note to touch on, we learned some new information over the last few days regarding the strategic partnership under the New York Life umbrella with Goldpoint and Madison Capital. We learned that several senior executives at Goldpoint resigned earlier this week, and Mr. Stringer has been asked to assume an oversight role for Goldpoint during the transitionary period. Both staff and Callen had a call with Mr. Stringer yesterday to discuss the announcement, and Mr. Stringer noted that things were still fluid given the abruptness of the situation, but he assured us that his commitment to PA Capital would not be impacted. Just in summary, staff and Callen, we're going to continue to monitor the situation closely over the coming weeks as more information becomes available. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Tony. Any comments or questions?
This is Ms. King.
Go ahead, Ms. King.
And forgive me if you didn't mention this. Was there any indication why the senior staff resigned?
Yeah, great question. An article came out recently in Pension and Investments, I think it was Tuesday evening. In that article, they noted that the team at Goldpoint left due to differences with the direction of New York Life Alternatives business. So we had on our call with Chris, Mr. Stringer, yesterday, he confirmed that basically the folks at Goldpoint they're unhappy with the collaboration efforts in the strategic direction of New York Life.
Thank you. How many staff you said resigned?
I believe it was six of their seven-person executive team.
Oh, for the same particular reason.
Yeah, that's all we're aware of right now. When we
okay.
Mr. Stringer, is that they were not happy with the strategic direction of the part that was last year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Any other comments or questions? All right, not hearing any, we can move on to item number three on the agenda, which is the Callen Private Equity Pacing and Reinvestment 2022 presentation. I believe we have either Mike again or also possibly Gary joining.
Yes, Gary Robertson here.
Morning, Gary.
Good morning. We do this casing study annually and create this memo. I'll just walk you quickly through some highlights. Your program is now 12 years in progress. Initially, it was a 5% allocation, and in more recent years, that target was increased to 8%, and then more recently to 10%. As I believe all you know, last year was a very unique period in the capital markets. Off the pandemic bear market, equity assets, largely driven by technology, appreciated just phenomenally. Private equity usually appreciates or moves, whether up or down, less than public equity, but in this case, it matched it. So your private equity portfolio appreciated 61% last year. Your overall program with bonds, et cetera, in it appreciated about half that, 30%. So what that did to the private equity allocation took it from 9.5 all the way up to about 12%. So you're slightly over your 10% mid-range target now, but well within your range with the upper limit of 15. And we'll look at that a little more as we go through this. We expect that, you know, capital markets are going to be a little more level in the future, hopefully. So it was a very, very interesting year. Annually, we do a pacing study to kind of gradually move the private equity in line with what's happening to the total fund. Now, the percentage of private equity you have is largely driven by the ups and downs of the main fund. And so we gradually, year over year, recast the numbers and calibrate commitments to meet the total fund's growth over the long term. So if we go to page 2, we'll just take a quick look at your history here in this very busy table, and I'll just highlight a few numbers. If we can go down to the bottom line. The first column is your commitments. The second one is what's been paid in to date, then what's left to get paid in. You can see that only about 55% of your commitments have been called. This is still a very young portfolio. Once you get up to 80, 85% paid in, that's going to be where you're starting to have a mature portfolio. The youth of the portfolio is really driven by the new increases in recent years where you had to increase your commitments. So those are fresh and not yet called. If you look at the next column, you know, you have distributions of $358 million and then your private equity unrealized value in the portfolio. To the right is the distributed to paid in ratio of 0.65. What that means is for every dollar you paid in, you've gotten 65 cents back of all those dollars. And so that, because of your long time in the asset class now, is you know, getting to be you know, pretty mature, so you're having good return progress in the portfolio. The next column, the RVPI, is for every dollar you paid in, you have about $1.25 of unrealized value in the portfolio. And then if you add those two together, your total appreciation. So for every dollar you paid in, you have 91 cents of gain in the portfolio right now. Your portfolio is, if we compare it to the Cambridge Private Equity Database, is very nicely in above median in the second quartile. The DPI of 65% is compared to a median of only 50 cents. And the total value to paid in of $1.91 compares to a median of $1.52. So, and these are against other professionally managed selected partnerships. So, you know, your managers are doing quite well for you. To move on to really the pacing study section, every year we update the model with what's happened in the main fund. We get actuarial updates from on your cash flows from your actuary. we update your projected return with Callan's latest capital market assumptions and adjust for uncalled capital and NAV changes in the private equity portfolio. We model each manager separately and then add them up so that you know, we can have a more customized approach to how we tailor this to your portfolio. If we turn to the next page, you can see the in the table there the commitment projection for this year. While we go out 10 years of projections for all managers, this whole exercise is really to get us to that first line, what should you commit in 2022? Because after that, we'll recast the whole thing next year. And this year, we're looking at a $35 million commitment to Abbott Capital Management. And as you can see on the bottom of the table, what we're targeting is to have about 70% in your two core managers, Abbott and Mesirow, and about 70% equally split between your small buyout and secondary specialty managers. One thing we look at is your current uncalled, and you can see on the prior page that the uncalled was $437 million. That's about 74% of your current target. So that is a good momentum to kind of push the portfolio forward. Even though we're making a relatively small commitment in the next couple of years, yeah, that is appropriate to help bring the portfolio down over time. We're also expecting that you're going to be getting a lot more in distributions in future years as your portfolio matures. This year, the portfolio distributed about $100 million. That was about 22% of your starting NAV, so very strong cash flow off your existing valuation. You know, if you took that money and recycled it into your capital calls that the portfolio had, you would have gotten to keep about a quarter of that, about $25 million. And so if you divide that by the beginning NAV, which that was distributed from, that's you're keeping about a 6% cash yield off the portfolio. So pretty healthy. We expect that to grow as capital markets stay liquid. So if we go to the next page and look at the graph there, here's the finale on the pacing area. You can see that you're currently at about 12.1%. That's the green line. The blue is the midpoint of your range. And you can see we're gradually going to be feathering that down over time back towards the midpoint of the range. Underneath, you can see there's going to be a motion when I'm done here to make a commitment of $35 million to Abbott's new vehicle. You've been committing consistently to their annual program. And so I'll just give a quick highlight on Abbott. Before we move to Abbott, are there any questions on the pacing portion of this discussion? Okay, here none. We'll move on to the next page. I believe you meet with Abbott periodically and are familiar with them since they've been with you for 12 years. It's a very stable firm. There was one planned retirement during the year. Katie Stoeckle, who was the chief operating officer, is retired, and they've redistributed her responsibilities and elevated some of the younger folks there. In terms of the new vehicle, there's only one change that's happening, is what Abbott has represented, and that would be they're moving their secondary and co-investment allocation up 5% from 20% to 25%. And 25% is still relatively modest for those you know, more opportunistic strategies you know, in compared to other fund-to-funds today. They're not changing their recommended mix. You may remember that they have four different pools that you can tailor your exposure in, but they always have a recommended mix, which is, you know, Callan believes is always pretty sensible, so we tend to go with it. It's 30% in venture capital and growth, 30% in U.S.-oriented buyouts in corporate finance, 20% in global small buyouts, and then 20% in European non-U.S. type investments. Moving to the next page, we'll take a quick look at their track record. And this is a very busy table, but I'll just focus your attention on the stoplight grading that we've done in the center there. Green is good. Yellow and orange are below median. You can see that over this cumulative span of 15 years, we've gone back a little bit farther than what your history is with them. They're very solidly second quartile. And you can see that in most years, they're first or second, and anything that's below median is really still developing to a certain degree, so those could improve in the future. If we go to the next page and look at their returns for your vehicles with them, we can see it's all first and second quartiles, so there aren't any performance issues or organizational issues with Abbott. And we're very happy with what they're doing for you. So I'll open up to any questions. I've concluded my formal remarks.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from board or staff? Quickly, Gary, just so I understand the suggestion that we do it to reinvest that $35 million commitment to the 2022 Abbott Capital's annual program. That's on page yes. four?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Not hearing any questions or comments, we can move on to item number four, which is going to be the approval of the 2022 private equity commitment recommendation, which will need a motion. Motion will be for the motion to approve the reinvestment of the $35 million reinvestment commitment to the Abbott Capital Annual Program 2022.
This is Ms. King. I'd like to make that motion, Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Ms. King. Second?
Yes.
Do we have a second?
Mr. Campbell, I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Motion passes. And thank you, Mike and Gary and Joe, for joining us today. We are going to head into closed session going forward. Please be advised that the investment... Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Goodbye.
Mr. Bell, this is Mr. Campbell.
Go ahead, Mr. Campbell.
I think that you have to ask if there are any objections before that motion passes.
Oh. Thank you. Any objections to the motion? Hearing no objections, the motion passes. Thank you. Please be advised that the investment committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following items. Item 5. As provided in section 19.85 sub 1 sub e Wisconsin state statutes, to deliberate or negotiate the purchasing of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The investment committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. Do I have a motion to go into closed session?
Mr. Klossman.
Thank you, Mr. Klossman. A second?
Ford.
Thank you, Ms. Ford. Any objections?
Roll call.
There are no objections. We'll go into closed session at time, like please, that. Jan.
We need a roll call and we'll run a video conference, Jan.
Mr. Campbell?
Sounds good. If I can, I'll take a roll call.
Ms. Ford?
Aye.
Ms. King?
Aye.
Mr. Klusman?
Aye.
Mr. Conrad, excuse, Mr. Kovac has left for his other meeting. Ms. Sawa?
Aye.
Mr. Bell?
Aye.
Quorum. And if you just say the time, I'll pause the recorder.
The time is 9:36.
Thanks.
It is 9:57 a.m.
Thanks.
Give me a few seconds here to just be in your mind with you.
Thank you, Terry.
Okay, you can come to
you,
Mr. Bell.
Thank you. Time is 9:57 and we're back in open session for item number 6, the approval of statement of investment policy update. Have a motion to approve the statement of investment policy update dated September 2nd, 2021. Change some percentages regarding total fixed income maximum from 26% to 30% and the absolute return minimum from 7%, reducing it to 6%.
Okay, just
a motion to approve those changes?
Just to be comprehensive, I mean, for the avoidance of doubt, there's the language in the, can you find it, Terry? It's either on page 2 or page 3. Yeah, that language is part of this motion as well.
Oh, and then the motion under 3, the update language that the staff will rely on to manage the fund's cash flow and that it can prioritize does that do it, Dave? David, or do we need more?
We can take into consideration the contents of the asset allocation memo dated September 2nd. So, yeah, that would do it.
Does the motion make sense, or should I repeat it for the members? I'll just repeat the motion. Motion to approve statement of investment policy update for September 2021, that the total fund income maximum goes from 26% to 30% and the absolute return minimum goes from 7% to 6%, as well as the language regarding the investment policy that the staff relies on for the cash flow and how it prioritizes public equity and fixed income.
Ms. King, I'd like to make that motion.
Thank you, Ms. King. Do I have a second?
Campbell, I'll second.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Any objections regarding? Hearing no objections, the motion passes. Can move on to item number 7 on the agenda, the Chief Investment Officer Report. David, you handling this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to use this opportunity to provide the committee with a performance update. Fortunately, it continues to be a really good story this year. What you have in front of you is something we would normally present at an August, if there was an August regular board meeting. But this summarizes our performance in July. July was a decent month. The fund was up about 0.8%. We delivered another roughly 20 basis points of outperformance. And all the other details that you would normally find with regards to July are either included in the package in this item or in informational. So I won't go into a lot of details there, but if you enjoy looking at that, it is available to you. We have a very, very preliminary estimate for August, given that we're now already in September. August looks like it's going to be even a little bit better a month than July. Our preliminary estimate is the fund was up somewhere between 1.2 and 1.3% in August, probably generating another 20 basis points of outperformance. And given yesterday's outfunded yesterday and the first day of September, and the fund's up again slightly this morning, our best estimate is the fund's up about 13.7%, roughly 13.7, 13.8% net of fees year to date. The market value as of yesterday is about $6.08 billion. When you look at the what that return turns into, what it translates into when you're talking about real investment dollars, it's about $756 million investment gains already with that 13.7% return. So it feels great to be able to say that and to have the fund at third straight month above $6 billion. So that's all with prepared remarks, but I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
This is Ms. King.
Go ahead, Ms. King.
This is really good news. 13% as of August. This is hopefully we can keep this momentum for the next 5 months, right? Or whatever it is left. Curious, how's this compared to the same time last year? Current trends of year to date? Last year's a tough year to use as a comparison. So just curious, like prior historical data, how is it by August time like this in prior years? How are we comparing ourselves? How are we doing?
I don't have the specific data. I know that last year, I think August or September and October were maybe flight to slightly down, but then it was a really strong November and December. I think if you looked at market historical data, September usually isn't one of the best months for U.S. stock markets. But again, on average, it's still probably flat, roughly. September and October historically have been bumpier, and then sometimes, but not always, there's optimism going into the year end, whether it's the holiday season or the new year. But it truly is random, Molly. When you're talking about a 4 month time period in a stock market, it's not safe to predict. The best estimate of where we might end up at the end of the year compared to where we are now is probably where we are now, because it is random. It could be a lot better. It could be, and I know that's not, I'd like to have the crystal ball and be able to give everybody comfort, but nobody's given me that crystal ball yet. So.
Mr. Bell, this is Mr. Allen. I'd like to make a follow-up comment about that. David is appropriately cautious here, but to address Molly's question, and I think something that Molly and the others are probably interested in, this good fortune that we've been enjoying is having a significant effect on our fund. I spoke to the actuary within the last couple of days, and he tells me that basically at this point, if we were to draw off a valuation, we'd be about 88% funded, and that the significant, this fact we have $6 billion in the fund now, pretty much, if we were to end the year today, we would eliminate about a third of the unfunded liability, and that would have a significant effect on how much the employer would be required to contribute. He also told me that for the purpose of resetting the what the city calls its stable contribution, which is done every 5 years, that this year there's an opportunity for him to use an asset value at the end of this year for the purpose of resetting that for the next 5 years. So if David's, I won't say it's his assumption, but if it's correct that we close out the years pretty much where we are now, that's pretty favorable winds, behind our back, and would go a long way towards helping this system stay funded. So I guess, David, you've got your work cut out for you. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, the markets do whatever they want to do, because they are, in fact, making them. But I hope that addresses your issue, Molly.
No, yeah, that does address too bad we can't close the year out right now. It's a great time. We can use that $300 million less unfunded liability. But yeah, this is great news. Good job, finance, you know, investment team. And let's hope this momentum continues on for the rest of the year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions for David? Not hearing any comments or questions, we'll move on to item number 8, the Callan Fiduciary Education. Is Mike, are you going to be handling that?
Yeah. Thank you. So, you know, periodically we do this fiduciary education. I think it's one of the best practices in terms of fiduciaries to re-educate themselves and remind themselves what their duties are as a fiduciary serving on the investment committee and the board. And so if we go to the next page, just framing the discussion, you know, there's a recommended fiduciary process for all types of funds. And I think in the past hour and a half or so, you know, I think we've touched on each one of these steps or referenced work that we've done in each one of these steps over the past year. And so this is a continuous process. It's not a linear process. We look at these things on a regular basis, all of them. So the first one is conduct fiduciary review. And really, this is, you know, I think one of the most important jobs of the board or the investment committee. Defining your risk tolerance, your performance objectives, in conjunction with, you know, paying attention to your liabilities and how all of those things interact with each other. That's really the asset liability study and setting the asset allocation policy, and that's what we've done in the past year or so. Designing the optimal portfolio is step two. And so after you set the asset allocation policy, the next level down is determining the manager structure. And we've been going asset class by asset class in this area over the past year or so, and we plan to continue that into 2022. We'll talk about formalizing investment policy, and you'll hear me talk about over the next couple slides frequently documenting the process and following the process. That's the most important thing you can do to ensure that you're following and following through on your fiduciary duties. Step four is implement that policy, and so that's you know, hiring managers when appropriate, or continuing to fund managers when appropriate, as we talked about today. And then step five is monitor and supervise. So we're reviewing performance on a regular basis, monitoring fees, monitoring trading costs, and making refinements as we go along. On the next slide, just wanted to define generally what is a fiduciary or who is a fiduciary. And there's someone entrusted with money or property who is charged with an obligation to act in the interest of another party. So as the investment committee or the board, you're charged with overseeing the funds within the pension plan for public employees in Milwaukee. The test of are you or are you not a fiduciary is one, either a legal designation. You as the investment committee and the board are the named fiduciaries for this plan, or through their actions, and that falls down into you know, staff in certain duties that they perform are acting as fiduciaries. So are your consultants, so is Callan, so are some of your other vendors, and we'll get into that a little bit more. So the biggest thing, you know, I mentioned it's largely determined by actions, not as much as job title or designation, but it's really, it's the actions that matter. And so, again, a fiduciary needs to be dedicated to a process, evaluating its outcomes and making successive changes to improve. How do you do that? There's four central duties of a fiduciary. First is the duty of loyalty on the next page. And so fiduciaries are to act solely in the interest of the plan participants. and making sure that you're providing benefits for participants and their beneficiaries. So, you know, as we think about, you're loyal to the fund and its participants. You need to avoid self-dealing or prohibited transactions, and those can, you know, as you see, conflicts can arise. You know, for example, as you're doing a search, you know, if board members or investment committee members have personal relationships, possibly with some outside investment managers, and you push them to get into a search, that can be seen as a conflict. If a board member or a committee member is financially benefiting from any vendor that the plan may hire, obviously that's a prohibited transaction and a conflict of interest. So always, you know, be mindful that you're serving the participants and what is in their best interest. How do you guard against that? You know, the second one at the top right is the duty of care. And so I apologize for reading some of these things, but they're sort of legal definitions. So fiduciaries must act with the care, skill, prudence, and diligence under the circumstances then prevailing that a prudent person acting in like capacity and familiar with such matters would use in the conduct of a like enterprise with like aims. So I think, you know, the important thing to take from this is, you know, appropriate consideration to facts and circumstances at the time. How do you find those? Well, you're bound to, you know, seek out the best information that you can. One of the ways that you do that is you hire outside professionals and experts like Callan, like your staff, like investment managers to actually manage the money and make the decisions on buying and selling securities. See that final line in the duty of care, prudence requires that a process is followed and documented. You also have the duty to diversify the investments of the plan so as to minimize the risk of large losses in investments. And you'll see that at the bottom right-hand side, or left-hand side. And then four, again, I guess we can't emphasize this enough, is the duty to follow plan documents. Fiduciaries must discharge his or her duties in accordance with the documents and instruments governing the plan. And so those include the investment policy statement, manager guidelines, any plan documents or charters establishing the fund. Those must be followed to ensure that you're upholding your fiduciary duties and obligations. You see the different types of institutional fiduciary funds. On the next page, obviously, you're a public retirement fund sponsored by a government entity and are subject to the laws of the state of Wisconsin and the city of Milwaukee. Where other plans you hear about, ERISA and things like that, those are more for corporate retirement plans, Taft-Hartley and others. But many of the guidelines and regulations and laws are drawn quite heavily for public plans taking guidance from ERISA. So it's good. It's a good thing to be aware of. Who are fiduciaries? So as I mentioned, you know, the fund sponsor or the board of directors or the investment committee, your trustees are officers and employees. It depends on the duties that they're performing at the time. So certain duties like rebalancing the fund, you know, certainly I think would fall under the category of a fiduciary act. Investment consultants, this says probably, but at Callan we consider ourselves fiduciaries, so I would change that to yes for Cal. Actuaries, attorneys, and auditors, probably not. Custodians, yes, in some instances, but I think in your instance, it's in the investment policy that they are not considered a fiduciary. However, you know, when you're saying you're not considered a fiduciary, you're still liable for any negligence or fraud and can be held liable for those things and responsible for those things. So if something goes wrong, you're looking at many of these folks on this page. So finally, recommendations for fiduciary conduct. And here's a sort of an eight-step checklist. Prepare and periodically review written investment policies. We did that just today. Diversify the portfolio. We've talked about that over the last year with the asset liability study and the manager structure studies that we've done and will continue to do. Use qualified professional managers to make investment decisions, whether that be consultants or investment managers who buy and sell securities. Account and control for fees and expenses, and I think you do that on a regular basis. Monitor the performance of money managers and service providers, both from a performance perspective and a qualitative perspective. Document the process. Again, we've done that within the investment policy statement, but that's really the thing that you know, you can look back to and hang your head on. As long as you're following the process laid out in the investment policy statement and other documents, you can be protected from any liability that may occur from adverse outcomes, as long as you're following that process. Engage expert legal counsel, which you do both in-house and externally in certain situations. And, you know, ensure persons involved in the investment decisions have the requisite financial competencies. And I think you've done that as well. So, you know, this was a quick overview. Hopefully it wasn't as painful as some of the other fiduciary training exercises you've been through. There are more details in the back in the appendix in terms of each one of the four fiduciary duties and examples. And so if you have any questions, you know, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meister.
Go ahead, Mr. Bossman.
Yeah, is Patrick on the line too?
No, Mr. McLean is not attending today.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you can't even answer this, Mike, but if you can, I don't, on page three, one thing we keep facing here in the upper left-hand corner, duty of loyalty, it seems so straightforward the way it's worded here, and it's the same thing that Patrick's presentation provides us. And it seems straightforward with words like solely, act solely, and for exclusive purpose. But every time we start talking about our fund sponsor having to pay what is due, we get some people that try to extrapolate this and muddy it to say, well, yeah, that's the words, but it extends to, you know, the fund. If you kill the fund sponsor by calling, you know, the full tab, then are you really exercising your duty of loyalty, which doesn't really wash, and we've never really aired that whole thing out, but they keep dropping it each time this is discussed. Because technically you could make that argument on any number of things. You could say, well, we have a duty of loyalty to the second bullet point about defraying expenses. Well, you know, then maybe our managers could say, you know, if you pay us fees way above average, we could do better because we could really hire better talent and things. And, you know, so where does that fuzzy end?
My question just goes to
is that the words on the paper on both presentations are very cut and dry, but then we always have folks from the board or whatever opining in to kind of change the words in interesting ways.
Well, I think, Mr. Klusman, this is an issue that's always a great concern to me as well. I've had conversations with Patrick about it, and Rudy Conrad as well, because Rudy was deputy city attorney for a long time, and he's our board chair. I think I can say, well, first of all, the governing document for this plan is Chapter 36, and it is very clear in two places. It says in 3608 that the city will pay what the actuary requires, okay? What's in the valuation has to be paid. And when I say valuation, that incorporates a stable contribution policy that has been adopted by the city. That amount has to be paid. Furthermore, it says in 3615 that the ERS board basically selects the actuary and also determines the investment, or not the investment policy, of course it determines the investment policy as well, but it determines the funding policy, including all, as you know from being on the board for a long time, it determines all of the economic and demographic assumptions, including things like the discount rate and life expectancy and expected age of retirement. All those things are determined by the board. And it further goes on to say, and this is, I mean, this is really a lockbox with a chain around it. It says that any change to this funding policy must be approved by a majority of 5-member majority of this board, and it also must be approved by the actuary as meeting actuarial standards of practice. And 3608, which is, deals with the requirement for the contribution, says that the contributions must meet actuarial standards of practice. So those two provisions, there's a nexus between them, and it's very clear. It's not at all certain that they can be changed in a way that would not be actuarially sound. So apart from any scuttlebutt or hubbub or you know, loose talk, the fact of the matter is the funding requirements for this plan are ironclad. And the state Supreme Court has said in 2018 that the members have contractual and property rights in their benefits, and they also have other rights, including the right to vote for the trustees on this board. But they didn't enumerate all of the other rights. Patrick has told me that he thinks it's quite likely, if this were ever to be, you know, come up in a contest, that the right to the security of the benefit and adequate funding would also likely be considered a right of the member. There are some cases on this as well that we can talk about offline, but the fact is that the funding for this plan is mandatory. It's not like some of the other states and other localities where people kick the can down the road. The opportunity to do that is really not present. So people can say whatever they want to, but fortunately, the city has always met its funding requirements, and I know there's some talk about, you know, a crisis, pension funding crisis emerging maybe in 23 or beyond. That hasn't happened yet, but if it does, the provisions in that charter are going to be controlling. And so I'm not too concerned about the possibility that somebody says the city doesn't have to pay, because the law is quite clear that it does. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but I thought it deserved a good response.
Yeah, thank you, and it was. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Klusman, and Mr. Allen, any other comments or questions?
Okay. This is Mike. I have a quick question.
Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, how is this presentation separate from our city attorney one? I'm still a little confused. It's not supposed to take place of the city attorney one, I'm assuming.
Well, the board has fiduciary education on an ongoing basis in several different ways.
Right.
We bring asset managers in to talk about their particular asset class and their particular strategy, but and Callan talks about asset classes also, and they also talk about the in this presentation, and of course Miriam and Patrick have given presentations as well. So this is all under the heading of fiduciary training and education, and yes, the city attorney's office will also speak again to this issue of, you know, fiduciary, the role of the fiduciary. It's just it's an opportunity for just another lesson, that's all, if I can call it that.
Okay, so it's in addition to.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, just wondering.
If you didn't like it, I should, you know, I'll take the blame for it. I mean, there have been times that we've had that.
No, it's fine. I actually just recently did the intro to investments at Callan, so it was like the same slide. No,
it's fine. Okay.
I mean, it's the same slides, you're right.
when the city attorney does fiduciary education, it's I would say it's more comprehensive in that it's it doesn't just focus on investments. It's I mean, on all responsibilities. And when we ask Cal to do this, I mean, as our investment consultant, it's more focused on it. But it should always be consistent. Just not always at the same time, I guess, or same at the same time.
Yeah, and certainly, I think your internal, you know, city council has much more expertise in the statutes, and as Jerry said, Chapter 38. So, you know, this is more of a high level supplementary exercise.
Mr. Klusman, I would opine also that I did not notice anything that contradicted our other training. So. They do complement each other.
It's just always good to, I think, always good to remind everyone.
Yep, can't have enough of this.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comments or questions getting the fiduciary education?
This is Molly. I'm not sure. Is Mike, are you finished? Because we didn't go through like slide 10 or anything like that. You want to continue, that'd be great.
No, that was it.
Molly, do you have any questions about those remaining slides? Or?
No, I do appreciate the reminder every so often. So this is really good, Mike. So I really appreciate this, and can't hear it at all, right? Keep us in. Always thinking about our responsibilities as fiduciaries, so appreciate that.
Thanks.
I'll give you a chance, Mike, and Aisha, this was a great lead, and I mean, it was great that you did. You've done some Cal events already as a board member, but I know that I always, on the conference list that goes into the board package, we put it under the I believe client conferences, anytime Callan has an upcoming session, and sometimes they go by different names and have different topics, but I know, Mike, with all the discussion we've had about alternative investments, I know, Mike, if you want to just take a 30 seconds or a minute to give a plug for your upcoming, the one that you highlighted to me, it's probably appropriate.
Yeah, thanks, David, for reminding me. So, we do periodic Callan colleges on a regular basis, and there's different types. There's sort of the introduction to investments. There's more of the intermediate investments. And we also are offering alternative investments, so sort of an introduction to alternative investments. So given the focus on alternatives, as we've talked about infrastructure over the past year, hedge funds, we just did a private equity or pacing study. If you have any interest in more education or information on alternatives, we are doing a virtual Callan College on October 14th. And so again, it's all virtual, so no travel required. And you know, David, I think, has the information in terms of registering, but if not, you can, you know, reach out directly to me as well if you're interested. And you can always find the list of conferences and educational seminars on our website.
Appreciate that, Mike. Any other comments? Great, not hearing any comments. Thanks, Mike, for your time today. We'll move on to item number 9, which is informational. So a few items there, unless there's any reason anyone wants to discuss those. Any reason anyone wants to discuss those, I'll make a motion to conclude this investment committee meeting.
Last one, a second.
I'm sorry, did I might have missed the first.
I thought you said you were going to make you a motion, Mr. Chair.
Oh, God, yes. I made the motion to conclude the meeting. Who did the second?
Klusman.
Thank you, Mr. Klusman. And the meeting is concluded at 10:32.